Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit, and I'm Dr. Lisa. How you guys doing? Good? So anyway, thanks a lot for listening. It's Dr. Lisa. It's Radio Free Brooklyn coming to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, the greatest city in the world. Let me just get the housekeeping over with that we are in a big fundraising push right now. Did you know that? Because everybody's been telling you about it. So we're doing a Drive to Five campaign, and because we're going to be 5 years old in May, and the future of the station is not that stable, folks. We need money, and we do a lot of really good things, and we do music, politics, talk, comedy, all sorts of stuff. And help, please keep us on the air. Go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. Okay, so today's going to be a very interesting, special day. I have a really amazing performer for you, performer, podcast. I have his Wikipedia page, okay? That's how I'm going to start. And he's an American comedian, Kevin Allison. And he started out on the State, you know, that comedy show on the State on MTV. And he has this really, really, really amazing, outrageous, no boundaries audio podcast, Risk. And it's also a live show, and he's been doing it since 2009. And he does his own stories, and then he also does it regularly in LA and New York and all these different places. And after you hear about him today or hear his story, you're going to want to get him into your own hometown. But you can see him at Caveat every month. So anyway, I think we're just going to get right into it. But okay, so here's the deal. Kevin, should I tell them what happened?
Yes, go.
Should I just tell them what happened? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Cause you don't even know what happened, Kevin. I was so nervous about having you on. I forgot my phone and I had to run home and get it. I live 2 minutes away. So, okay, folks, here's the deal. So Kevin Allison is on the show today. It's a big deal, right, Kevin? I mean, you understand it's a big deal, right? Your show gets a million downloads a month and mine gets 110, right? It's a big deal for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? I need as much help as I can possibly get with my scheduling. You and I have been emailing back and forth. And at one point, I think we mixed up saying Thursday the 6th, and the 6th is Friday. And it was one of those things where I think I actually wrote it down in my calendar correctly, but then in my brain, I was thinking Friday. So ultimately, it's my fault that I am not sitting there
in
that studio.
You know what, Kevin? This is such a beautiful example about how your vulnerability is making me feel stronger and more confident and more. You're actually helping my self-esteem, because I do that all the time, and I mix up places and stuff like that. And I've a reputation for it, but knowing that you do it and you're able to do everything you've done help. You've already helped me today. Okay.
Oh, I will say that I didn't know that I had ADD until I was officially diagnosed with it last year.
Really?
But I spent my entire life, my entire childhood, being one of those people who always thought, oh my gosh, my brain can't keep track of details. I can't.
Right.
I always felt oh my gosh, everyone else
right.
can do basic scheduling stuff and keeping track of money and just all these things a lot of people kind of take for granted. I mean, everyone struggles with time management and detail-oriented stuff to some degree.
Yeah.
But for people with ADD, it can be so overwhelming that like you just shut down to a certain extent.
I know, and then people think you're this is what happened to me. People thought I was like stupid, right? Do you know what I'm saying? Especially as a child. As the youngest daughter in a Jew family where the oldest was a boy, you can imagine what it was like. I felt like a fucking moron. It's all right.
Yeah.
It's all right because it's all good now. I've used it. We're here. We're here right now, and that's all that fucking matters.
Yes, and I will say that, you know, kind of owning that and asking for help was huge for me because at a certain point, when I first created Risk, my podcast and live show, I recognized right away, I was like, okay, in order to make this what I really and truly believe it can become, I am going to need to find some people who really get it, really love it, and really appreciate me, but whose brains work differently from mine and can help me keep track of stuff.
Right.
So it's important to remember that, too, that not to be afraid to reach out, ask for help, look for ways that you can work with people who's, you know, have strengths where you have weaknesses.
Right, right. And give them something back.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, folks, I'm not talking to you, Kevin, now. I'm talking to them. So here's the deal, folks. So Kevin has been, you know, like, so we're going to do this on the phone, which is great, which is fine. So the way we set it up was Kevin was going to tell one of his stories, and then we were going to psychoanalyze it. And, you know, because I – and Kevin, you know this, right? I was going to remind everybody I'm a self-proclaimed psychotherapist.
Uh-huh.
Did you know that? I don't have – like, I don't have a license. I just have to make sure you know that and everybody knows it's that. So, before we do that, like I didn't really, like normally what I do is I do the intro and a little intro, and then I want you to do a little intro on yourself because we didn't really have a pre-interview and tell people where to go and look for your stuff and all that. Will you do that first?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Cool. So go ahead, tell us about yourself and where we can find your, before we do this.
So I create an audio podcast called Risk, and it's a show where people tell true stories that they never thought they'd dare to share in public. The idea is, you know, there are shows out there that are very narrative, like The Moth or This American Life or Snap Judgment, but all of those are family-friendly for radio, for public radio. I saw, because I'm a very kinky, very out gay man, that there was a hole to be filled there for a podcast where people tell stories that they would actually tell to their therapist that are not necessarily family friendly, where, you know, the things in our lives like sex or violence or trauma or
cannibalism, fucking cannibalism. Jesus.
But also very funny.
Orgies. Yeah, I mean.
Mortifyingly embarrassing.
Oh, great stuff.
A little bit, you know, hard to you know, sometimes, you know, outrageous language and stuff like that.
Well, so, you didn't. Okay, I also want everybody to know how well produced and how well thought out the show is, because it's like every story is really well thought out, and like it's really like it's so entertaining.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it takes, you know, we always feel like the show should be 5 times more popular than it is. We put
a lot of work,
you know. It's a show that has, you know, we started with a budget of zero, But we put so much tender, loving care into the preparation of the stories. We do a lot of coaching. And, you know, you were saying that you're an, you know, unlicensed therapist. That's what we have become on my staff.
Yeah.
In the way that we help people prep these stories. We've had to learn, oh, this is how people sometimes behave when they've got PTSD. Or,
right.
Oh my gosh, this person is maybe a little bit on the spectrum. So we're going to have to work with them being able to go into this kind of
So you're coaching.
You as we go.
Right. And you help the people. Like, the people aren't always storytellers. They're people that have had really extraordinary experiences. And that's what I think is odd. And you help them develop their story. And I think that is really, I mean, that's a big deal, because you're not just getting like other entertainers and stuff like that, which I think is really awesome.
Yeah, we do have, you know, we do have comedians and writers come on. But many of the most memorable stories that have been shared on the show have been shared by people who have never stepped foot on a stage before. So, yeah, it's very exciting that way.
It's a story meritocracy. It's a story meritocracy.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And we always have both storytellers and listeners talk about the show being therapeutic for them.
You know?
Someone just emailed me today. I haven't seen the email yet, but someone on the staff alerted me. They were saying, hey, you got to check it out. Someone emailed and said they were raped and said that listening to the show really helped them process it because they had heard those kinds of stories on it before. We get those kinds of emails all the time.
It's a it is a service. I mean, it is. It really is. It's a really, so Kevin, you and I are both in the world of like, don't keep it to yourself, share it.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're all better off if we just, like, put it out there and, like, no, like, forget about any shame. Like, there is no shame. No shame. Unless, you know, well, there's some. I mean, like, you know, like the president or whatever. But if you really own it and, you know, and you have compassion and forgiveness and stuff, just put it out there.
Absolutely.
And I wanted to ask you about therapy. Have you been in I know that. You've been in therapy. Have you been in therapy a lot, or?
I have. I've had a mixed range of experiences with therapy. The first therapy I ever tried was gay group therapy. So it was gay men, and the woman who was the therapist running the group was a lesbian, and she was very, very quiet and very. She didn't have a dominating presence in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a very, it was kind of like the equivalent of Sanders and Warren supporters yelling at each other on Twitter. It was this weirdly acrimonious group, and it got out of control. And the therapist left us.
What?
Yeah. She went off to have a baby and sent a replacement therapist in her place, and then after a couple of sessions, the replacement therapist said, you know what, she said she doesn't want to return. So the group broke up with
you know what,
abandoned.
See, that's exactly why I am so cynical about therapy. I mean, I have stories like that too. You know, there's no Yelp for therapists, and a lot of them, anybody can get the degree.
Right. It's there. You know, what I found is I'm always encouraging people to go into therapy, but I always say, don't just go with the first person you sit down with. Think of it like dating. Almost.
Yeah.
You really have to find the right person. Like when I turned 30, I was with a Jungian therapist, and a lot of good came from that. That was very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a little bit sex negative. She was a little bit conservative about sexuality. And I am such a kinky sexual person.
Mm-hmm.
And it developed into a mom thing. I have a lot of, my mom is incredibly sex negative. And that's a big thing that I, so that drama was unfolding between me and her. So finally, when I turned 43 or 44, I decided I hadn't been in therapy for, I don't know, maybe 10 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But I had where I was at on my journey in kink, because I always think of BDSM, of being in the kink community and mm-hmm. trying new things and mm-hmm. meeting new people. I always think of it as a journey.
Yeah.
With a lot of kink play can be very psychodynamic, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's almost like I'm going to say it's sort of an art form, isn't it? Because it is a journey and there is development and there is personal growth and you have a relationship with the form, right?
Oh, yeah. And
yeah. It's like having an art project.
And you can screw up and you can get screwed up by other people.
Sure.
You can, it's a Pandora's box. So
yeah.
I met for lunch my friend Melina Williams, who is a kink educator and just a brilliant person. She told an amazing story on Risk called Slave about race play, about dominant and submissive role play where people's race is a factor. There was a play that was just on Broadway mm-hmm. called Slave Play that dealt with that exact
right.
same.
So they acknowledge it directly. They acknowledge like directly in the relationship, like their race.
Yes,
and stuff
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah. You're
that's
you're
part
playing
of the deal.
With race as a mm-hmm. part of what you're talking
right.
about in the play.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, Melina, she told this incredible story on Risk called Slave,
mm-hmm.
and we became close. And I went out to lunch with her one day, or dinner, I can't remember. And I said, I really feel like I need a new therapist. And she said, have you heard of Kink Aware Professionals?
Wow.
It's this network online where you can find therapists or doctors or other people like lawyers, you know, who are in the BDSM community.
Mm-hmm.
So I found my current therapist, who I've been with for, I think, 4 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because he is about my age
mm-hmm.
and also a gay man. And he studied, his whole life's work is researching kink. He's written books about it.
Oh.
That. Yeah. And so it's fascinating because I feel like my therapist is now like a peer. I feel like my therapist is now like a more educated friend.
mm-hmm.
who can like totally relate to what I'm talking about?
Yeah,
has a lot of like research behind it.
Right.
I've been very happy with this new therapy setup that I'm in now.
Well, I think what you're involved in to me seems like complicated. If you do have to really understand it in order to. It's a culture. Like if you were a shrink and you went to like. You know, South America, you'd have to learn about the culture there before you could do therapy, what things mean, how things affect people emotionally. And that guy knows.
Oh, absolutely.
He has a big,
you know,
broad perspective.
Yeah. And I think mm-hmm. that men, I might be making a generalization,
mm-hmm.
but I think that men have a tendency to avoid. Like opening up and communicating and like being more like vulnerable about just like unpacking stuff and processing stuff together. So I think that the kink community is extremely blessed by the presence of women. I think that I think that gay men are starting to learn. I think the whole kink community learned a lot from gay men, you
mm-hmm.
know, like in the 60s and 70s, gay men were like the avant-garde of kink.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the internet came around, I think that a lot of straight people and lesbians and like, you know, people of all around the spectrum started exploring kink more publicly in a
mm-hmm.
bigger way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're now at a place where gay men are starting to learn from women's intuitions and insights and mm-hmm. just the way that a lot of women are just more I don't know, eloquent about saying, hey, you know what? When you run into this sort of situation, it might be time to take a time out and process what's going on between the two of you. You know, it's like, just, like a lot of men just don't have that tendency. So it's understanding that for me as a gay man involved in a lot of kink activity, I have to keep in mind, this guy might not want to really process and talk and unpack this stuff, but we really got to do that, you know.
Well, now you know what I go through. Now you know what I go through with my husband. Exactly. Exactly. So do you want to, you were going to tell a story, our plan. You were going to tell a story, and then we're going to psychoanalyze it together, right?
Yeah.
Does that sound good? I'm kind of excited about it.
Yeah, and you know what? I would say you can feel free to interrupt me too.
Yeah,
you know, I think it would be more fun if you felt like you could do that too.
Oh, okay, okay.
I mean, you know, I could tell the story straight through, but you know, since
we're both here,
each other.
Yeah. Okay, I'll speak up.
Yeah, sure.
So, give us a little intro. What were you going to? What did you pick out?
Yeah, this is, it's a story that I first told while my husband and I were still together.
Mm-hmm.
But I keep telling the story because I really feel that stories are well worth returning to years later because our histories change, our perspectives change, and you know, so I still tell this story to this day, even though in some ways, you know, some people might think, oh, that's kind of outdated now. But anyway,
but it's like rereading a book, and as in, like, you know, that totally.
You're
okay.
One
question, then, just to get perspective. Yeah. So this is somebody you were married to, and how long were you married and how long were you divorced, just so we can have some perspective? How long since you've been married?
We got together. We were together all together for 9 years.
Okay. Okay, guys, that's a solid relationship.
Yeah, and then we separated 10 years ago, nine or 10 years ago, it's been since we've been apart.
But you're still good friends.
We are still good friends.
It's so great. It's so great. And have you had other long-term relationships since?
You know, I have not had an intimate relationship on this level since then. I would say, more casual relationships since then.
Is that something you've discussed in therapy as well?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. A lot. I would like to have a relationship on this level of, you know, it was an open relationship that we had, but there was no, you know, it was very clear we were primary partners. You know, we didn't even think of ourselves as polyamorous, to be honest with you. We thought of ourselves as having an open relationship in that we could have sexual encounters with other people, but not really seriously dating other people.
Mm-hmm.
Now I think of myself as being more polyamorous, which might be something that affects, it might be that navigating that terrain of the polyamorous world and people who think of themselves that way, it might be that I and or some of the people that I have become close to since then have, you know, been confused or trying to figure out, you know, dipping our toes in, like, wait, how serious do we want to get? And what does it mean to have a, you know, a casual versus a more serious relationship? So, you know, yeah, it's
an
ongoing process.
Being part of the kink community, I mean, it's so funny because you're like somebody that is like publicly just completely intimate with the public in a way, right?
Well, yes, in a way.
With your own bound, where you have control.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing for me to navigate because as the host of Risk, part of my job is to be as transparent and authentic as I can be,
mm-hmm.
and that is always a challenge because I get depressed very often.
Sure,
don't want to sound depressed on the show.
You're a performer.
Yeah, I will sometimes have profound experiences that I would love to be telling the audience about, but that I feel like, it would really be like the person I'm going through this with would feel like it was really, you know, too much to be revealing. They wouldn't appreciate that. Or maybe there is really something about it where I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready for people to know that about me.
Well,
so all of that is always a struggle.
But what's really funny to me is how, and I don't mean this in any kind of, I'm afraid to use this word aggressive, but I'm going to use it, and I think you understand. I mean it in the kindest way. I mean the most respectful way. I'll say that for sure. Is that you are very aggressive about being intimate in public. But I wonder if that's also inversely sort of uncomfortable for you when you're alone with somebody, you know, like a performer who, you know, like how people are so introverted but extroverted at the same time. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So you may be like, you may have such a drive to be intimate in public because you repress it or you're afraid or you avoid it on a one-to-one basis. Is that kind of what?
Oh my God. Let me tell you, that whole like Judy Garland thing, like put me on a stage in front of 400 people and I can talk about the most vulnerable stuff.
Right.
The moment I step off of that stage and have to go into the green room and socialize with just like 4 or 5 people, the social anxiety.
Wow.
I will say that, you know, I don't know how much I buy astrology,
mm-hmm.
but the description of Aquarius, I am an Aquarius,
mm-hmm.
the description, oh, this person wants to reach out to all of humanity, but we'll keep you at arm's length.
Mm-hmm. That's you. Right. Now, do your partners,
exactly me.
Do the people that you're dating talk about that? Do they say like, how come you're so like this with me when you're that? Do they notice that?
Oh my goodness. Well, my husband used to be very aware. Oh, Kevin really needs to go into his own universe. Kevin really needs like off time. And the thing that disappoints me the most about
mm-hmm.
it, and I was confessing this to, you know, J.C. Cassis is pretty much my best friend. She's the producer of Risk, and we talk.
Oh, yeah. I know who.
Oh, I think J.C. has been on your show before.
Yeah. Well, her song. Yeah. But Chris is working with her, Chris Gersbach. The great Chris Gersbach, who we love.
That's great. Anyway, so I was confessing to her the other day when we were talking that I feel bad because I'm not bipolar, but I am kind of manic depressive in mood swing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel bad that the public gets positive, you know, whatever, all very good energy, Kevin. And oftentimes,
right.
the people I am very closest to, they have to deal with all my negativity, my fatalism, my depression, my, you know, like.
Right. And then the people who are closest to you are so annoyed. They're like, Kevin, everybody,
oh my
right?
God.
So annoyed. It's like, you know, you're really fun. People don't know what you're like. They think you're fun all the time. Do you like question, like, I mean, I'm like this, and I always wonder about people who like, you know, like you, somebody who I really, you know, think like, wow, like you've accomplished so much. And I always think, like, I wonder if they feel like they're just like they're not getting it done the way I feel like I'm not getting it done. Do you feel like that sometimes? Like, do you sit around going like, wow, I got a million podcasts, a million downloads.
Oh my God.
You're like, I'm fucking failing. I didn't get invited to the Kennedy Center or something.
Yeah, JC talks to me about this all the time. She's like, she said, listen, there will never be an amount of downloads that you're happy with. Like,
totally.
You always feel like you're failing.
Totally.
So, yeah.
I'm so happy. You don't know. I mean, I love you for saying that. I just am so happy to hear you say that. No. I mean,
yeah,
that's what I think.
I think gratitude is actually kind of a skill. I think it's a
really
muscle.
Interesting.
I think that one of the things that frustrates me about gratitude is that I feel like, kind of like, you know, the more you meditate, the more acclimated to getting into a meditative space you become. I think the same is true for stuff like gratitude. That you almost have to kind of train your
It's cognitive.
Brain.
Cognitive.
Yeah.
I
will say, at 50 years old, I feel like I've got a lot of strengthening of that to do.
Mm. But aren't you a little, I mean, because I'm not at the level you are, but I mean, I'm still like that. I probably would be if I ever got there. But like, don't you feel like, I think there's part of me that feels like if I give up that, whatever that is, that, you know, like, oh, pushing yourself not good enough thing, that I will actually fall behind.
Oh my God. I'm so glad you said that. Yeah. I was talking, this is another thing that came up in my conversation with Jay-Z just the other day in the States. So after I graduated from NYU in 1992,
mm-hmm.
my sketch comedy group, The State, got a show on MTV. So we were super lucky, super blessed.
And also incredibly well respected. That's like in the, you know, history of comedy, isn't it? I mean, it's a really, important show. It is.
A lot of young comedians were very, very influenced by The State.
Yeah.
But the thing of it was, that group, it was a group of 11. That is a huge group for a creative, you know, supposedly egalitarian, democratic group of people. And it ran on fear. It ran
on fear. What do you mean?
The reason we were able to, like, keep producing such incredible content is we were terrified of, oh my gosh, if I don't write an incredible sketch, then one of the other of the 11 of us will incredible. So it created all this competition.
Oh.
And kind of, you know, so the fear kind of fueled and drove us, and it helped us to create an incredible amount of incredible material, but eventually it killed us. Eventually it got to the point where, you know, any creative person or creative group is going to have ups and downs.
Yeah.
And if you run on fear too much, then when the down times come, that can sink you, you know?
You mean as a group?
Oh, yeah.
You all wound up doubting yourselves as a group?
Yeah, exactly. What happened was we quit MTV to try to go to the networks. We went to CBS, and they fired us after one special. So now the group was like, holy cow, did we just throw our career away? So we spent about a year trying to, you know, can we make a movie? Can we come up with another TV show? And it was just this period that all creative people go through of, oh my gosh, what's next? We're on hiatus. We're at a low point now.
Right.
And that's when the backstabbing began. And that's when people were like, you know what? it's not worth it being, I could be more successful without you guys and yada yada. And so the group, like the Beatles, you know.
Yeah, right. No, but.
Yeah, if you look at the dissipation of the Beatles, it's a very similar thing where they, you know, they get,
yeah.
their manager dies and now they're like, oh shit, what do we do? And they start to like be like, you know what, fuck you guys. I could be more successful without you, you know, where. You really got to watch yourself with that kind of thing.
Yeah,
you really
I think
find ways to stay positive.
And also, competition in any creative field is ultimately what's going to ruin, I think, any creative person in a way. Like,
yeah,
in the art world, you know, if you get somebody's going to get in the show and you're not, and then if you start thinking that your work isn't as good because it didn't get in that show. Then you can't be thinking about that. You got to be thinking about the work, not who's approving it or liking it. You can only do what you do.
Yeah,
it's really hard to keep.
It's a hard balance.
That is really hard. That is really hard. So I want to go back to your intimacy issue because I really want to know more about that.
Yeah.
So, why? Like, I'm like wondering about. Like, you came out when you were 24, and you came out publicly, right?
When the state was on MTV, we did a sketch called The Jew, the Italian, and the Redhead Gay, where it was the three guys playing those roles were obviously just those people, you know? So it was a way of being like... you know, letting people know I'm gay. I mean, I have this incredible history around coming out, which is one of the reasons that I created Risk, because I've been upset. I knew I was gay from the beginning of consciousness, and that created long-term trauma. I grew up in the 1970s in Cincinnati, Ohio, which at that time was incredibly conservative, very sex negative, very Republican, very Roman Catholic.
But what was your family like? Like, what was your experience at home?
Well, you know, sex was just not talked about. Sex was like the shameful sort of thing that should be swept under a rug. My mom was incredibly uncomfortable, even with the word sex.
Mm.
You know? I remember... when I was 12 years old is when I came out to myself. When I was 12 years old, I finally said it out loud to myself.
Wow. Wow.
And I remember thinking, okay, when am I going to come out to my mom and dad about that? And that was 1982.
Wow.
Sexual Healing by Marvin Gaye was the number one song at the time. And it was playing on the radio. My mom came in to the kitchen where my sister and I were, I don't know what we were doing, you know.
Eating.
Something. And, she said, when that song comes on the radio goes off. On the radio.
Oh man, so, were they religious?
Oh, man.
Churchgoers?
Extremely devout.
Was there hell? Was there potential hell in the atmosphere there?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh.
I was raised understanding that I would go to hell. I spent a lot of time wondering if I should go to confession to privately talk to priests.
And
then,
that really would have done. That would have done very well there.
That could have been a disaster. Yes, incredible. It is incredible that I, you know, like for example, I was an altar boy. I was a choir boy. I went to the Royal School of Church Music in the summer times. So I was so immersed in Catholicism that. I think that my awareness that I was gay was very potently helpful to me, because I think that a kid who, I mean, also I was not the best looking kid.
I find that hard to believe. I mean, those are adorable pictures, and you've got gorgeous blue eyes and red hair. Oh my God. Okay.
But I think my own awareness that I was gay, like, kept me protected from anything weird happening with adults. Like
that. Right.
Adults, when they prey on children, they're looking for kids who, you know, are confused, don't know what's going on. You know what I mean?
Right.
Or, you know, feel especially vulnerable. So,
but
I don't know.
I'm going to say that I bet that you exhibited like gay, whatever that is, you know, gay juju, gay vibes before when you were growing up, right? I mean, you're just whatever that is, right? Do you think?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But not in a way that adults would feel like, oh, I could get one over.
No, where adults could fucking, this makes me mad at adults, because adults could fucking ignore it and let you deal with it instead of like making it okay.
Yeah.
You know,
yes,
that makes me mad how those adults are.
Yeah.
But they do the best they can. So what happened, was being gay like a tangible thing? Like, did you know any gay people? Was being gay in like, I mean, I guess you could find it in the media, but was there any examples of it? Did it seem real or?
What it was that I was right from the beginning, when I was like a toddler, I recognized that I was physically attracted to boys. Especially boys' butts. I was like, oh, my God, boys' butts.
They're cute.
And what happened was that, you know, I started having experimental experiences with other boys the way that kids do, you know, I'll show
playing
you
doctor.
Show me my, yeah, all that kind of thing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was all becoming very crystallized to me. And what I did was, and this is, we might not get around to the story itself. But
no, you know what I was thinking? We should do that another time, because we were going to do that in person. And I think that really should be done. And I, you know, and also I'm having such
fine.
A great time hearing about you that when we do the story next time, it'll be even better.
Right. So what was, there's a little idea covered in that story, which we're talking about right now, which is that a friend of mine, when I was 5 years old, explained it to me, the kid, an older kid who lived next door. He said, Kevin, you know, when guys say gay and fag, they mean stupid and lame and horrible and, you know, laughable and, you know, someone
mm-hmm.
you don't want around.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason those words mean that is because they also mean a boy who likes boys. So that's where the connotation of being so awful comes from. So I was like, oh my God, I was like, okay, that totally clarifies it for me. I've got to hide.
So it's your peers. It was your peers.
Exactly. Yeah. It's fascinating that, you know, people will use the excuse that when they say something is gay or that someone's a fag, oh, I didn't mean homosexual. I just meant awful and lame and horrible. Or
yeah, right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's...
But that's why, you
mm-hmm.
know, because people associate those things in their minds. So I grew up thinking, oh my God, you know, if it ever comes out that I've got this thing hiding inside of me, then I'll lose my friends, I'll lose my family, I'll lose, you know, I'll be an outcast.
So yeah, I mean, it's not even about being gay from like, you know, it's about being different. It's about like... You know, like, I mean, it could be your sexuality. It could be that you liked a kid that didn't ever want to have hair and shave their head every day and couldn't help it. You know what I mean? It could be anything like that.
Oh, my gosh. I think,
just
I
being
think
a freak. You were a freak. You were a freak
exactly.
in a really normal place.
Exactly. And that is why risk affects people so much, when they hear people coming out about whatever it might be,
mm-hmm.
you know, coming out about there was alcoholism in our family, or coming out about I got obsessed with such and such a thing, is that people have a tendency to think, oh, I'm the only person going through this
right.
sort of thing, or
right.
oh, no one will like me if they learn blank about me. And that is, if you hold on to that kind of thinking too long and stay too secretive about anything for too long, it starts to traumatize you.
It blows you know? Up like, in your head. It gets way bigger and out of proportion. That's why I think
exactly.
it's... But I have a question. I want to get your opinion on... So I have this theory, I mean, about the biology of being gay. And, mm-hmm. like, I think that... So I think that, like, to me, this is, as you know, I have no training of any sort, but, but I mean, to me, it seems like being gay, not for everybody, but for you and for many, many other people, it's genetics, it's biology. So I think that, and, you know, in nature, maybe, you know, with cavemen, maybe gay people didn't reproduce. Okay. But I think that because being gay has been repressed for so long, a lot of gay, let's say, just to narrow it down, let's say a lot of gay men have gotten married and have families and have passed on the gay genetics. So I'm wondering, and I know brothers who are both gay and stuff like that, you know, and so I'm wondering, do you think there's any gay genetics in your family? Do you think maybe your father was repressed or any of your relatives? Do you ever think about that? Have you thought about that?
Well, some of my relatives definitely were. I think that it's interesting to look at it now that the queer community is a lot more diverse. The whole queer community is a lot more diverse
yeah.
now, and people are really acknowledging the fluidity of things.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that there's nature and nurture involved. I do think that in my case, that I was definitely biologically gay from day one, that I came out of the womb as a little gay boy. And there's a lot of scientific material that shows that the hypothalamus is different
mm-hmm.
for, you know, gay men and yada that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I do think that there's a biological thing there for a lot of people. But then again, there are a lot of people. I think that my therapist at least says that women tend to be have more neuroplasticity around sexuality.
Mm.
That women are more likely not to get super stuck on a fetish or a type.
Mm, that makes sense.
Or, yeah, and that women are a little bit more open to new possibilities or suddenly being attracted to someone where they're like, what the hell? I didn't know I'd end up attracted to someone like that.
Right.
Whereas men are a little bit less fluid.
Yeah.
And kind of get
that makes sense.
In stuff. So yeah, I do think that there's nature and nurture involved in it, but that I myself, I think that I was very genetically mapped
mm-hmm.
that way from the
mm-hmm.
beginning. I have no idea about how it might be passed from generation to generation,
right?
Like that, yeah.
So how did your family wind up? They obviously know you're gay. How'd they wind up accepting it, or what happened?
They did. It was hard. I knew my father is like, for him, Catholicism was all about the Aquarian kind of Christ, the you know, merciful, compassionate, everyone. So my father was like he was a huge fan of Martin Luther King and people like
that. Oh, wow.
He was into social activism and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. So he was
enlightened.
Very,
mm-hmm.
Immediately he was like, oh, great. I figured we'd probably have a gay kid.
sense of humor.
Five children. You know?
Oh, so you, wow.
Like, I figured one of them might be. So anyway, but my mom, what I did was I waited until I was 18 years old, and I waited until it was a few days before I was going to go to NYU.
Oh. So,
what I was doing was I wanted to make sure the plane tickets were bought and, you know, the tuition.
So you were afraid to tell her. You were afraid to tell her.
I was. I really was. Because I just didn't know how she would react, considering that she just didn't like the idea of talking about sex at all. You know?
Did your brothers or sisters, how many kids? There's five, you say? Did they know? Do you think they know?
No, you know, it's really interesting because when I came out to my brother, I came out to my brothers and sisters a while later. In fact, it was interesting.
After your mother? Wow.
Yeah, I came out to my parents before I came out to my brothers and sisters.
That's
weird. Which is really kind of interesting and odd when I think back on it. Like, I'm very close to my little sister, but when I was 18, I guess she was 15. Yes, she was, she was young. So I think I was worried about coming out to her.
Right.
And my older brothers and sisters, I was not as close to them. So I just had no idea how they'd react. Well, it turned out they were all completely fine. They didn't care at all.
They didn't care, right? No.
Right. It was only my mom for which it was a struggle at first. You know, she cried a lot. She asked me if I would maybe consider joining the priesthood in order to kind of escape all that. And you know, it was interesting because I talk about the Jekyll and Hyde thing that shows up in Risk and everything like that. That there was always a part I was hiding, and that you know, when I became a comedian as a defense mechanism for feeling like I was so different and weird inside. I became like when I was. I remember in first grade, I really realized that it was valuable to establish myself as the class clown. Because I kind of intuitively realized they're going to laugh at me one day. Everyone's going to laugh at me and call me names and like think I'm weird. So if I can make them laugh, if I can control the reason they're laughing at me.
Right.
Then maybe they'll be like, okay, we accept him because he's allowed to be weird.
Well, it's like you're calling it out. You're calling it out first, so everybody's okay with it.
Right. So so my mom, we wouldn't have conversations throughout my childhood about sex, but we would have conversations throughout my whole childhood. Do you have to be such a nonconformist? Yeah, she would be like, do you have to be so different? Do you have to, like, be so expressive? Do you have to, you know, like, say things that make other people uncomfortable, yada, yada. So, and I think that might have been sublimation. I think that we might have actually been having the conversation about my sexuality when really we weren't.
That's a really repressive message, right?
Yes. So when I did, I do remember like a week after I came out to her, like right before I went to NYU, we were driving in the car and she said, are you sure you're not just doing this whole gay thing as another attempt to be a nonconformist?
Oh my God. The poor woman. I've got compassion for her. That's a very small, box that she put herself in, right? I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean,
well, I think that's super common. I mean, I have a ton of compassion for my mom as well because my mom dearly loves me and loves all of her children.
Like,
taking care of her whole family,
five kids,
everything to my mom. And so she really was concerned that being gay would be hard for me, you know?
Yeah.
She was concerned.
Yeah.
That she was concerned that people wouldn't like me because of it.
Yeah,
right?
And also, like, you had the vision. You probably had it somewhere in you. Like, you wound up, like, moving to New York and making so much happen. But if I was, you know, as a mom, you would be looking at, like, a boy, and you wouldn't be imagining that. You'd be imagining him in Cincinnati and trying to get a job at, you know, General Mills or whatever, Hallmark Cards or whatever's out there. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I think sometimes people will share stories on Risk. Like, a woman just pitched a story to us about her mom being very overbearing and negative and critical, and mm-hmm. that she finally decided to cut her mom out of her life. And it was a very rewarding story. I mean, I was kind of rooting for her at the mm-hmm. end of that story that she shared, because I was like, yeah, it does really sound like you should get your mom out of your life.
Yeah.
Some of the nasty things her mom was saying to her whole life long. But I don't feel that way about my mom. I have very mixed feelings. I feel like, oh yeah, there was, it, like you were saying before, she was doing the best she understood how to be doing.
She sounds like she comes from, like, a really good place, good-hearted, a loving place. She just doesn't have, like, the range of experience to really understand what you're talking about, sort of thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Which leaves a person like me, you know, like, years later, when I had that Jungian therapist who was kind of sex negative and kind of reminded me in some ways of my mom, like, it leaves a person like me realizing, oh, there is still this archetypal energy in my head. There's still this super ego kind of voice that is saying, do you have to be such a nonconformist? And aren't you kind of a freak? And shouldn't you be ashamed of yourself?
That's probably why sex is so much fun for you, because it's all on your terms. You know, it's, you don't have any frame of reference for it. It's all on, you know, what you don't have anybody, like, it's all brand new. It was like a new thing that you could get, you know, make your shape, right?
It continues an whole
exploration.
Like an act of rebellion. To
Kevin, this went, I'm so sorry to interrupt you. This went so fast. Can you believe it? We have 2 minutes.
Oh, my God, yes.
And so fun. I really enjoyed this. So fun. So I want you to tell us, like, where we can, like, go and see all your stuff, and tell us, and then I've got to tell people about Radio Free Brooklyn. So go ahead, okay?
Sure. You can find the Risk Podcast wherever audio podcasts are hosted, but the best place to go is risk-show.com. And then you can find us on all the socials, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Risk Show. And then on Twitter and Instagram.
And you have a book.
We have the Risk book, which is, like, some of our very best stories we've ever had on the show. You can find that at Amazon. And on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at the Kevin Allison.
Kevin, thank you so, so much. And I'm going to, like, tell, I now have to do my Radio Free Brooklyn. Thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. We are the greatest station in the Western Hemisphere. We are always doing new things. Get our newsletter. We have monthly meetings and mixers, free beer, free pizza. You can find out about that at radiofreebrooklyn.org/newsletter. You can also, we also have a mobile app, so you can, like, listen to us anytime you want to and get a great mix. We have everything on this station. It's a really, really great station. And stick around, because our programming this afternoon is fabulous.